200 episodes. Thank you to everyone who listens, joins as a guest, or supports the show. For this special episode, I'd like to take it back to one of my first speaking engagements and opportunities as an entrepreneur. Once I began familiarizing myself with how to network, who to network with, I eventually became informed about a company called 1 Million Cups. If you are unfamiliar with the organization, this is straight from their website. Based on the notion that entrepreneurs discover solutions and engage with their communities over a million cups of coffee, the Ewing Marion Kaufman Foundation developed 1 Million Cups back in 2012, a free program designed to educate, engage, and inspire entrepreneurs around the country. Through the power of volunteers, the company has grown to more than 160 communities, and I was fortunate enough to speak at the Tampa chapter here in Ybor. This is where I met Andy. We've stayed in touch ever since, from startups, teaching entrepreneurship, and engaging with entrepreneurs worldwide. Dr. Andy Gold has a lot to offer to this community of entrepreneurs, but let's kick it off with a question, Andy. What does entrepreneurship mean to you?
Well, for me, entrepreneurship has always been about developing sort of a certain way of thinking. It's not so much about starting a business, but having a certain way of thinking that can profoundly change other people's lives. That, to me, is what entrepreneurship is all about.
I love being able to help others and others helping me on this show. Each time I sit down, each week, sometimes I record a few per week, but I'm learning new tips to the trade. There's no textbook in this business. There's no blueprint. We have to continue to network to make it happen. So thank you for that wonderful introduction. And to everyone else, welcome back to That Entrepreneur Show. I am Vincent A. Lancey, and I am excited and want to thank everyone once again for your support through 200 episodes. It's been an incredible ride, and I don't know if it will be slowing down soon. One of my many goals for this show is to interview an entrepreneur in each of 50 states, and it's not something that can always happen on the new season, getting new states, so we have a long way to go.
This segment is sponsored by Bedrock Business Builders, a small business startup specialist. Start, build, manage.
If it is your first episode with us, welcome. Each week since December 2019, I have brought on the founder of a company or brand to share all of their learning lessons along the way to help you improve your journey. As I mentioned, college educator, social entrepreneur, he does it all. Andy Gold combines his 12-year career on Wall Street, experience raising capital to start up a hedge fund business, founding several companies, teaching entrepreneurship, co-founding the InLab at HCC, and the list could go on. I'm very excited to catch up with you, Andy. Dr. Andy Gold, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Well, Vincent, I just want to thank you so much for, you know, first of all, 200 episodes. Wow. I mean, that's just amazing. I want to thank you for everything you've done over the years that I've known you to inspire so many people. But I want to point out that 200 episodes from 2019 to today, I mean, gosh, that speaks to your entrepreneurial competence in terms of persistence. I mean, to navigate through COVID, to keep pushing forward, to keep cranking out these presentations, amazing testament, you know, to your persistence and, you know, your entrepreneurial capability. So I just wanted to recognize that it's not easy to do. But I think as people watch these interviews, they'll learn that that's really a key attribute of a successful entrepreneur.
I really appreciate the kind words. And as you said, persistence and consistency, especially during COVID. For me, someone who's trying to speak in schools with students, I have the books done, the work is done, but all the budgets were gone. So there was a lot of things that prevented the launch, but you have to keep going, even though it's hard. You still have to tune out the noise and find ways to keep making it happen. I've had the privilege, as I call, to sit down with so many entrepreneurs around the world to help give me advice, as I mentioned, give them advice, and overall help everyone, including the listeners. Would you mind introducing yourself a little more to our audience, Andy, on a personal side? Then we're going to dive right into all your great work you're doing at HCC.
Well, the work we're doing at HCC is really just a tiny contribution to the overall work that's taking place, not just in Tampa Bay, but regionally, nationally, globally, to help lift other people up through entrepreneurship education and so on. I was born and raised in New York City in Manhattan. I'm a product of public education. I went to a state school in New York, upstate New York. My first career, as you mentioned, was on Wall Street for about 12 years. And I learned an awful lot about finance and business there, but, you know, just really had my soul like ripped out of my body over that 12 year period of time. And for me, it was a pivot point in my life. You know, I was much younger then. I knew I didn't want to stay in that industry for a lot of different reasons. It just didn't align, I think, with, you know, where my values were at that time. So I switched, and I just was somebody that dove into or fell into entrepreneurship. You know, I didn't know anything really about it. My grandfather had owned a dry cleaning chain of stores in New York City for many years. So I got to kind of work in there. That was like my limited exposure to small business enterprising. But I learned a lot, you know, through starting six small businesses, had my fair share of, you know, business failures and mistakes. I call them learning adventures. And that kind of led me more recently to Hillsborough Community College in Tampa, Florida, where I was presented with this amazing opportunity to co-create an entrepreneurship program at a community college. And it's been now almost 10 years. I can't believe it. And we have stood up a nationally recognized community college entrepreneurship program that's doing great work and really trying to help a specific population that animates me. And it's the population of people that are under-resourced, underserved, that kind of know that there's another side to life. They see these business owners, they see entrepreneurs on television and the movies, and they're like, gosh, that seems cool. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to get there because of where I have grown up and my life circumstances. And I think the work that not only we do at HCC, but community colleges in general, which are highly inclusive entities, is really creating a metaphorical bridge to allow individuals to cross that chasm and realize their dreams. So like for me, it's been a really profound experience.
Well, congratulations on 10 years. That's amazing. How many students you've touched along the way is uncountable. And here in Tampa and St. Pete, I'm sure you could speak of too, the amount of quality entrepreneurs in this community is astounding. In the beginning of the show, obviously my main episodes were Florida, New York, where my homes are. And just to come across so many incredible businesses as I'm searching LinkedIn to network and using my network, it's amazing. But where'd you go to college up in New York?
I went to Oswego, which is on Lake Ontario. It's a little bit north of Syracuse, New York. And it was really an awesome experience because, like, for me growing up in Manhattan, upstate New York to me as a child was a small city called White Plains, which is about 30 minutes outside of New York City. And to me, that was like the world, like New York City, White Plains was upstate New York.
Yes.
When I actually went to upstate New York and got to make so many amazing friends that came from communities I was so unfamiliar with, you know, rural communities and people that grew up in really challenging environments. It was really an awesome opportunity for me to broaden my horizons and become aware of, you know, so many other people that face different sets of challenges.
My sister is a graduate of Cortland upstate as well. And from where you were in college, probably night and day weather to where you are now, Syracuse is up there.
Yeah, I mean, they never canceled classes, and it would snow relentlessly from late October until really mid-April, late March. And when I first went there, I lived in a dormitory. So when it got really cold, it would get icy. And because they didn't cancel classes and it was very windy on the lake, Lake Ontario is like an ocean almost. It's a huge body of water. They would set up these ropes and students would be like on this rope line walking so they didn't slip to get to the classroom buildings. And that's just what we did, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, my sister had told me that at Cortland when it's super snowy, there's just ropes.
Yeah.
That is incredible. Thank you for sharing that for all my New York listeners. I hope you resonate with that a little bit. You mentioned before that your soul was getting sucked out of that job you had. You weren't really finding happiness. Let's talk a little more about that transition where you dove into entrepreneurship.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think the first thing is everybody struggles to figure out, you know, what they want to do with their lives. Yeah. And there's sort of like a conventional path you go. Sometimes it's out of necessity, especially today with record levels of student loan debt. You know, sadly, so many young people don't have choices in career options. They have to kind of go toward a career that can compensate them sufficiently to service this, you know, what I think is a ridiculous amount of debt that has been, you know, loaded onto their backs. But what I discovered, well, and I had some student loan debt, just to give you perspective, like when I graduated from college, I had like $6,400 in student loans, which is like, you know, nothing today compared to what students have. Yeah. But, you know, to me, it seemed like a lot, you know, at the time. So I was like paying it off and, you know, diligently making those payments, but it did cause like a disruption in my personal budget. But when I kind of had this epiphany as I was working toward the end of my career on Wall Street, that, you know, I like some of the decisions I had to make money for the investors that I was responsible for managing their money. Sometimes those decisions were counter to my core belief systems, you know, kind of like hoping, for example, for bad things to happen in the world because we were betting that the stock market would go down. Mm-hmm. And that I was almost like wanting bad things to happen. I was like, what the heck? What kind of job do I have? You know? So I left, and I actually, the first thing I did is I started working for a friend of mine, this guy, David, that owned a small like IT consultancy. And he would go to like, it was actually money managers that were trying to set up Bloomberg terminals at the time. Right. And, you know, we would go in and kind of set all of that up. And I loved it. Like the technology back then, this was, you know, in the like early 1990s was just really coming on. So I really enjoyed it. And then one day, I think I may have shared this story with you, but I'll just share it with your audience. And
yeah, please.
Because it really like did transform my life to this day. So one day, Dave calls me on a Sunday and he says, Andy, we have this a large nonprofit agency that needs our work, our help. It's a nonprofit run by nuns out of St. Malachy's Church on 49th Street. The nonprofit is called Encore Community Services, and their mission is to help serve a displaced and homeless senior citizens living in the Midtown West Side of Manhattan. And I said, great, you know, I'll go down there. Sounds cool. So I happen to be Jewish, which has little to do with the story, except that I had had like zero interaction with nuns my entire life. And I'm so old, Vincent, that there used to be a TV show on called The Flying Nun. And it was a comedy featuring an actress by the name of Sally Fields, who went on to make many movies. And it was about a nun that lived at a convent who could magically fly. Okay. And she wore like the habit, the outfit that nuns wear in some So I didn't know, like I knew nuns didn't fly. Like I wasn't that crazy, but I was like, what if they're dressed in some outfit or something, you know, I should act like it's no big deal. So I remember mentally preparing myself, you know, for this interaction. So I go down there and I'm greeted by Sister Lillian and Sister Elizabeth and Sister Pat, who are like dear friends of mine today. And they're not dressed like that. They're like these voracious business women doing this high impact work. So I spent about 2.5 days there. And it was so awesome to see what they're doing, you know, helping these people that have no one helping them. Mm-hmm. And I was so inspired by it, you know, so I go back to Dave's office like 4 days later and he's like, oh, how was it? Great. Got all their problems solved. He says, terrific. Now you need to invoice them. So I said, really, Dave, like, have you been down there lately? Like they're doing some really cool work and, you know, healthcare advocacy and meal delivery and all this. He's like, look, Andy, I understand, but they're a large nonprofit. We're a business. I can't pay you if you don't invoice them. So I said, don't pay me. You know, how about that? And he got really pissed at me, Dave. I remember he was a friend of mine, but he was like, Andy, look, you need to invoice them and you need to invoice them today or else you can't really work with me anymore because this is a business. So I like begrudgingly invoiced them, but it really bothered me. You know, like I felt odd about it. And I knew they were they had like 65 employees and probably was not a big deal. But then I began to think, how many small nonprofits are there in the New York City metro area, kind of like single shingle executive director led nonprofits that can't afford IT consultancy, but desperately need it. And I went to speak, I did my customer discovery, and I went to speak to Sister Lillian and Sister Pat, and they were like, OMG. I don't think they said that, but they were like, you know, Andy, there are so many small nonprofits that need IT consultancy, but can't afford it. So I began to wonder, how could I start a business that could provide IT consultancy for free to nonprofits and still be able to pay my mortgage, still be able to save money for my young kids at the time, college education and so forth. So I realized I wasn't that smart back then, not that I'm smart today, but I realized I could kind of start a business like Dave's and service for-profit small businesses and then take whatever profits I had and do whatever I wanted with those profits, because they're my profits to do what I want. So it took me, I started in my home. It took me about 12 months to get to a point where I had enough paying customers to get out of my house and into an office and hire two people. And we were serving law firms that were like 10 people or less, and accounting companies, and a few beverage companies. The Sobe brand beverage was one of my first customers early on. They later got sold to Pepsi, but that was like one of my big customers. And then I, about 15 months in, had enough profits and started to send people that work with me and myself included out to small nonprofits that couldn't afford these services. And we would help them at no cost. And something really magical happened. And I want to just share this with your audience, because I think it's important. I was worried that my paying customers, when they found out what we were doing, would be annoyed. They would be like, well, wait, we're paying you, they're not paying you, what's up with that? But I started to share this with a couple of my paying customers, and the exact opposite happened. They were like, wait a second, Andy, you're telling me that we pay you for the services, and then you take a certain portion of those fees that we pay, and then you give services away for free to small nonprofits that can't afford it. I'm like, yep, that's what we're doing. And this first guy told Paul, he was like, that's amazing. You're telling me that by us hiring you, we're helping to change the world and make it better just by hiring you. And I was like, yeah, exactly, Paul. You know, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I was like, yes, that's the deal. So all of a sudden, as I told more and more of my customers, they began to refer so many. I went from 3 employees to 28 employees in about, I don't know, 9 months or so, because the demand for our paying clients really blew up. And what that did was it allowed us to scale our impact on small nonprofits, where we got up to over 70 nonprofits that we serve. That lesson learned was really powerful for me, and I think relevant today, especially. Because today, for the first time in American history, the majority of the US population are millennials or younger. So millennials, Gen Z, and then the youngest generation, Gen Alpha, born 2010 or later. Now, when you look at those three generational groups, you discover a couple of very similar commonalities among them. The first of which is by far the most educated generations ever in the history of the country, the most inclusive and diverse generations in history. And the last thing is they are by far the most cause-focused generations in history. Not all of them, but a lot of them are very cause-focused, to the point where they're willing to switch brands and pay more for something with a company that's doing something cool in the world. And that's really important for any aspiring entrepreneur to recognize today, that if you are thinking of starting a business and you don't have some profound cause that's animating that business, you're going to get rolled over by a competitor that does. And whether you believe in social entrepreneurship, care about people that are struggling in life, it's really irrelevant. You need to kind of get ahead of that curve as a business owner today And I think that can really take you a long way in business.
I always am very appreciative when guests come on and share such valuable lessons learned like that from start to finish. And it just shows you too how quick you can scale if you stick to something you're passionate about, especially, I take that mindset with what I do. I just keep plugging like we spoke about. Keep plugging, be consistent, and good things will happen. You're a perfect example of that. But it is a long way from your Wall Street job. What are some areas you found challenging when you're on your own opposed to being in a company?
Well, life as an entrepreneur can be very lonely. You know, there's a lot of data that suggests that entrepreneurial co-founders or founders have a much higher propensity for mental health challenges and some really serious, you know, people look at it kind of like as this glorious world of independence and all that stuff. The truth is entrepreneurship is brutally difficult, you know, and it makes me sad when I hear people focus on these statistical outliers in entrepreneurship, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs and Bill Gates and so forth. These are not the norm by any means. The norm is the everyday person that's hustling to try to do something. The failure rate's very high still in the world of entrepreneurship. So, you know, for me, it's like a daily grind, but the grind becomes easier when what you're trying to accomplish has some personal meaning, some personal purpose. When you're chasing dollars, when you're chasing wealth or fame or whatever it is that's driving you, and this is very common among, I'll just call them novice entrepreneurs, people that are new to entrepreneurship, they tend to think about who am I going to sell my company to before they even have a customer. What's my company valued at? You know, I'm going to go on Shark Tank. I want to make a lot of money and own an island and retire when I'm 37 years old and have people serving cocktails to me. That is sad, but you know, it's something people have to learn. You know, these are the people that are jumping out of a plane without a parachute, hoping to build one as they're cascading down to the ground. So I think education, where I kind of come in, helps, but sometimes people hear what you shouldn't do, but still do that anyways, because they either didn't absorb it, don't agree with it, and they have to kind of learn that themselves. People always say, you know, you learn so much from your failures, and I could have totally done without the lessons I learned through my failures, but I did learn a lot, but man, were they painful, you know? And I try to save so many people who are aspiring to be business owners from those mistakes I made. And sometimes I'm successful. Sometimes I don't even know because I lose contact with people and I just hope I had a good impact. But that's kind of where I land on that.
So many great points there. Again, in entrepreneurship, education does go a long way, but as you mentioned, there's a high failure rate. You can't teach work ethic. I mean, for me, I'm grateful that I've had my parents to look at, work hard, teach me the right way to do things. And now in entrepreneurship, surrounding myself with great people like you, having these conversations, because yeah, we can't do it alone. We could go without our failures, quote unquote, but they do teach us one or two things, which leads me to this question, because I'm very, very interested to see who you would choose to learn from when speaking any entrepreneur throughout history. Who are you going to learn from?
Well, I have two people, one is dead, and so I can't ever talk with him. And the other person never existed, but I would have liked to have talked with him. So the first person who's no longer alive is Benjamin Franklin. Now, Ben Franklin to me is like the quintessential American entrepreneur. While he's known as a founding father and an abolitionist and really fought voraciously to make slavery illegal, was unsuccessful in that attempt during the construct of the Constitution, he was a tremendously successful business owner. During a time when there were extreme conditions of uncertainty in the world and hyper resource constraints. But yet, Ben Franklin did something very unusual at the time. He was opposed to patenting any of his technologies and inventions. He had the lightning rod and the the Franklin stove and bifocal glasses and all these things he was inventing. But when you read about him and you discover why he was opposed to patenting things, he thought, well, gosh, I can't think of everything that goes into an invention. Why would I want to stifle innovation by protecting an idea for 20 years so someone can then kind of make it better? Why not just open it up to the public domain and let people build upon my ideas and accelerate innovation? And despite him not securing foundations, he died a very wealthy man. But I'd be really curious to learn more about his journey. He was known as a person that was very frugal, somebody that, you know, a penny earned, a penny saved is a penny earned, that kind of mindset, which actually I think was his wife that came up with that. But he had his eye on knowing that to sustain a business, you had to have a financial model that made sense as well. You can't just wing it and kind of do things. So that was the first person. The other person is Willy Wonka. I'm very much amazed by the fabulous imagination that Willy Wonka, the character, had. But more importantly, people who are voracious idea generators, to me, are just that, you know, they're like idea people. We all know people like that who are like sharing their ideas or won't share their idea because it's so great, you're going to steal the idea from them. But the difference between that idea person and Willy Wonka is Willy Wonka took action on his ideas. You know, he was a very action-oriented person. And I think that that is really the dividing line between kind of like idea folks or, you know, dreamers versus entrepreneurs, is people are willing to actually take action. That requires a certain amount of risk. That requires an ability to accept failure. And that requires, you know, an ability to kind of be very adaptable, you know, as circumstances change. So I think those are two people off the top of my head that I think I would really have liked to talk to and learn more about.
Taking action, adapting to different circumstances. These are things we have to live and breathe as entrepreneurs, but we're taking it one step further, and all my listeners know what's coming next. Where would these meetings go down if you could pick the location for each?
Oh, gosh, let's see. Well, with Willy Wonka, it'd have to be in his chocolate factory.
No question.
Who wouldn't want to meet there? And I think with Ben Franklin, like, he was known to have like these laboratories, kind of like an early Thomas Edison, you know. So in like one of his laboratories where he actually like put together these different inventions. Now, interestingly enough, he even though he was a bit overweight, or at least appears to be in different images of him, he was a voracious swimmer. I only know these little things because I've read a lot about him. So it's not like I am smart. I've just read a lot about the guy. So he thought about, how can I make swimmers be able to swim faster? So he developed early stage fins, you know, to put onto your feet. But back then there was no plastic. So he had the concept right. He was using like wooden blocks. He would strap them to his feet. And he would sink because the weight of these, the wood would bring him down. But conceptually, he had the right idea. So I'm like fascinated by how someone like thinks that through, gives it a go, takes action again, has a little failure, but it doesn't, you know, stop him.
I love both choices and I love the reason behind. Thank you for sharing all of that. You've shared so much throughout this journey so far, the difficult parts of entrepreneurship, some lessons learned all about the InLab at HCC. I think it is the perfect time now to shift into the spotlight story. And I'm on the fence about continuing these stories past episode 200, but I do see the value in them personally. And I know there may be listeners who come on specifically for this analysis from my great guests. But if it is episode one with us today, this is the point of the show where my guest and I go over another entrepreneur's journey to help you get some more perspective, some more ideas, hopefully. And as we have an entrepreneur involved in the academic world today, I'm going to introduce the great story, one that I have never read before, in the entrepreneurial journey of Anna DiGilio. According to EdWeek, half of teachers with second jobs currently work in a role outside of education, and 5% of teachers take on a second teaching or tutoring job outside of their school districts. Nearly one out of every five public school teachers does have this second job during a school year. Some teachers work 60 hours a week and then have their second job. Across the country, teachers are renting out their homes now, I'm learning, with Airbnb. 1 in 10 Airbnb hosts, or approximately 45,000 people who use this service, are teachers. You can also find these educators working as baristas, online courses, working for Lyft and Uber. But one teacher who took the leap outside the classroom into the business world is Anna DiGiulio. She spent 23 years working as a second grade classroom teacher and then soon realized the power of internet and had to take a chance to get creative with her creativity skills. Within a few short years, she built a $1 million business and continues to impact the education ecosystem in all ways. This is a little interview in the Forbes article where she shared her story, what led to her success, and some tips for educators, and we'll go through a little bit right now together. How did your entrepreneurial journey begin? In 2012, I was searching Google for some ideas for my classroom. I came across the site Teachers Pay Teachers. I noticed that teachers were creating lesson plans, activities, and classroom decor resources digitally, and they were selling them to each other on this website. The article asked, was this a wake-up moment for you? Yes, I was completely inspired by what I saw on this site. I always had a creative edge in my teaching and had been creating lesson plans and resources on my own for students for years. When I realized that I could package my ideas, activities, and resources into a digital PDF and then sell them on the internet, I was hooked. And along with one more, was this a monumental moment for you? Yes, from that day on, I worked an additional 40 to 60 hours per week after coming home from my full-time teaching job and created resources to sell online in my online Teachers Pay Teachers store through my blog, Simply Skilled in Second, and more. I began creating branded resources and product lines that would help me build a name for myself within the online teaching world. I created brands such as Flip Flack Books, Tabits, Spinits, Teachits, and more. Andy, what's your takeaways from this article?
Wow. I mean, first of all, thank you for sharing all of that, that story, but the data at the front end of that story. I think, you know, another person you might, maybe you've already talked with her, but she's a friend of mine, is Erin Meager. I don't know if you know her. She's the founder of Kalepo Coconut Oil. It's a local brand here in Tampa Bay, very successful small business owner and a former elementary school teacher. And her students kept telling her, you know, stop telling us about, you know, how to start a business. Why don't you go start a business yourself? And she was like, you know what? I should. And she had this idea for a coconut oil company, and it has grown tremendously and is one of the shining stars of the Tampa Bay and Florida region. So you might want to talk to her. But I think in general, context matters greatly. In a country like Korea, South Korea, teachers are, and Japan, teachers are viewed as nation builders. You know, there's a different perspective. They're really revered within society. And I think here, while people provide lip service to teachers, oh, teachers are important and teachers are great. The proof is in the pudding of compensation for teachers, you know, and it's just not there. You know, a teachers work endlessly to help make the lives of students better. This society around teachers generally is not very supportive. And that's really disappointing. It's not, I don't think, a money issue, because there's an awful lot of money in education generally.
Yeah.
It's just how the money's being allocated is really where I think the problem resides. But for me, I don't think education needs to be reformed. You hear a lot about education, reforming education.
Yeah.
I believe education needs to be transformed. I think you need to like chuck out what we're currently doing in education, and you need to do something totally different. And I'll just give you one example for why that is.
Please, yes.
In K-12 education particularly, there is this teaching to the test that grows as a student goes through their educational journey. So another good data point is Gallup tracks student engagement in learning in their own education. And when you look at young students from kindergarten through fifth grade, they are generally very engaged in their education. It, at the point of fifth or sixth grade, all the way through the end of high school, they become increasingly disengaged. The level of engagement declines. And when you dig into it, it declines because there's no room in the curriculum for anything that animates a young person. There's no room for dance. There's no room for music. There's no room for entrepreneurship. It's like you're taking these tests and you need to perform well on the test, because if you don't, your life is going to be ruined. And you need to take pre-calculus in high school, or maybe even AP calculus. Why? Because if you want to get into a good college, you have to have that. And what ends up happening is young people are becoming increasingly risk averse. They're worried when they enter the workforce about making a mistake. I mean, everybody's worried about making mistakes, but I mean, it's gotten to the point where, like, this need for direction, like, you know, supervisor, my boss, can you tell me exactly what to do? And I'll do it because I'm good at following, you know, directions. But that's not what society needs. You know, they don't need what are called convergent thinkers. You know, that's what we teach in education is, here's a multiple choice list of answers. Pick the right one or the best one out of the four answer choices. That's convergent thinking. You're handed some choices, find the best one. What the world needs are divergent thinkers. People that look at this list of four answers and say, you know what? I can think of two other solutions that are better than those four. That's what's needed, but that's not what we're teaching. And that needs to change like yesterday. So I think by the time they reach someone like myself, in a experiential environment and entrepreneurship program like we have, it's not too late, but there's a learning curve there to kind of get people acclimated to what is needed to really, you know, have value in society today.
Well said there. And if you look outside nations, different places around the world, teachers are at the top of the pay scale in many places. And here, for whatever reason, it just hasn't been that way. A great way to put it was perhaps funds aren't being allocated the correct way, because there is money education. But Andy, I can't thank you enough for joining us for this very special episode 200. We go back since the beginning of my entrepreneurial journey, and now I'm glad to introduce you to my audience because of all the golden nuggets you left along the way. How can everybody find you, the website, all the work at the InLab, anything you could share with me?
Okay, well, I have, I think, back there is my Twitter is Prof. Andy Gold. You can find out more information about the InLab by going to hccfl.edu/InLab. So HCC for Hillsborough Community College, FL for Florida.edu/InLab. There you'll see all of our programming. We have college credit programs, the shortest of which is a one semester certificate in entrepreneurship. We have community programming that's free, workshops and events. We do a lot of work with military veterans. We have a unique partnership with Syracuse University, which has a national leading veterans entrepreneurship program. And then we have a research institute where we do design thinking work in the community. But one of the things that's very important to mention is we have a seed fund. So students that complete either our one semester certificate in entrepreneurship or any of our entrepreneurship degrees or certificates, or the veterans non-credit program called Strive, qualify to apply into our seed fund. We've had the seed fund. It's called the Everyday Entrepreneur Venture Fund. We've had it for about 2.5 years. We have funded 28 businesses so far that have come through our programs. I'm really proud to say that all 28 businesses have made it through COVID. Some with bumps and bruises, some are really flourishing. But just to give you some data, last year in 2021, the 28 businesses generated a little over $3.6 million in aggregate revenue across the 28 businesses. And it's growing from there. So I think out of all of the stuff I do, that's been really an exceptional opportunity. And I think it's a hidden gem in the Tampa Bay market.
Thank you for bringing it to light. It will be in the show description. Just scroll down in the notes. And Andy, thank you once again for joining us for episode 200. And to all my loyal listeners out there, be sure to check the show out at Vincent A. Lancy or at That Entrepreneur Show on all social media. My website is vincentalancy.com. And we will see you next Friday for episode 201 on That Entrepreneur Show. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vincent. Nice to see you.